Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network, hosted by Blog Talk Radio. The Middle Ground looks at today's political issues from left, right, and center. We're always civil and always looking for that middle ground where real conversation begins. You're here tonight with hosts Eric Beiler and Michael Charney. We thank you for joining us and hope you enjoy the next hour of The Middle Ground.
Welcome, everyone, on this nice Tuesday evening, and thank you for joining us on The Middle Ground. This is Michael Charney. I'm here with co-host Eric Beiler, and tonight we have a guest we're going to bring in named Ron Garrett, who's from a fascinating organization called Patriotic Millionaires. I'm sure that's probably made you as curious as it made me when I first heard the term, but he'll be coming on. It's a group of people who have, actually, I think Ron's own terminology in one way or the other, have won the lottery. I'll let him explain what he means by that. Not literally won the lottery. But he has been fortunate enough to have achieved a certain level of wealth, and now he and a number of compatriots are urging Congress and others to actually tax them more than they are now. They want to contribute more of their fair share. And so we're going to have Ron on in just a few minutes. This whole tax issue, though, has me thinking about an amusing and enjoyable but by no means brilliant Bill Murray movie called Groundhog Day, which essentially has Bill Murray as a somewhat acerbic news reporter who is forced to report on Groundhog Day festivities in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania, and finds himself in sort of a recursive loop where he wakes up each morning and it's the same morning all over again, and he uses the time to actually try to change things. The second half of that story is more hopeful than the first, but it certainly feels on some mornings I wake up and I read what's on the news about the fiscal cliff, about the top 2% of people earning over $250,000 and the Bush tax cuts, or what's going to be passed and who's holding what hostage, and it absolutely feels like a version of Bill Murray in Groundhog Day, because it seems like we've heard it all before. We're hoping, and I'm certainly hoping, and I think Eric and our guest Ron would also hope, that in this recursive loop that we seem to be caught in, at least each time we go through it, we'll learn a little bit more, and maybe this is the time we'll actually behave a little differently, as Bill Murray did towards the latter half of the movie. But it certainly feels a little bit like that kind of a loop. I'm going to welcome in, as always, my co-host, Eric. Eric, how are you this evening? I don't know if you feel quite the way I do, but it certainly seems like, tax hijacking redux to me on some days.
Well, I have some hope that it will be different, because the strategy to make Barack Obama one-term president by opposing any and everything that would help our economy or create jobs has failed. And I don't think that there's enough partisanship in the Republican Party to invest in that strategy for another 4 years with not having any impact on Barack Obama's legacy. I guess they could have impact on his legacy, but they don't have impact on whether he becomes a three-term president, because that's not possible. So I think with that, and of course all of the talk that's coming from the grown-ups in the Republican Party about taking a different approach to social issues. And I know that, if you strip away all of this extremism on social issues, this issue about to what degree do we ask the people who are very, very wealthy to contribute to the investments we need to make in our future? To what degree do we ask them to adhere to our laws? And to what degree do we simply invite them to make our laws? That's really, I think, at the heart of what the Republican Party is, and all this social issue smokescreen stuff was really just a way to, I believe, distract us from the intent and the actual impact of these kinds of policies that do the opposite of what I think would be best. In other words, they don't ask very much of the super wealthy, or not enough, and they don't expect them to follow our laws, and in fact invite them to make our laws. I think that's hurt us. I think it's hurt us really badly. Without the smokescreen, I think that all Americans, including Republicans, are going to take a closer look at those policies, and I think there's going to need to be some compromise, in part because the smokescreens are really what create the rigidity. All of the stuff about immigration and gay people and, you know, what rights should women have and all that stuff, that's what causes people to be really bitter and angry. That's going to, I think, ease back a little bit because it's just, well, it's not going to be electorally successful anymore. I think people are concluding that. And so without that kind of hyper-partisan vitriol, then we're going to take a more, I don't know, studied, more sober look at these economic policies, and I think we're going to find some middle ground.
Well, it's interesting. I'm hopeful as well. Although I think that there's a bit more to the ideological underpinning than just about whether or not the wealthy pay their fair share, whatever that means. Well, I'm sure we'll talk about that with Ron in a few minutes. I mean, there are fundamental differences in beliefs about how to grow the economy, and you know, I think that while I'm optimistic that there is compromise on the table, and I'm optimistic that things like the Grover Norquist pledge will be sort of, you know, shunted to the background of at least for a while, and certainly for the Senate. I still wonder whether some people are just, you know, going to not want to bend that far because ideologically they don't believe it's the right thing to do for the country. And I still think there's a real open question there.
Well, at the very least, they'll have to ask themselves, should I represent the will of the people or not? I think that before there was some question of what is the will of the people. Now they have to ask, well, should I represent the interests of the voters, or should I represent the interests of my funders? And it's a very simple question, and I can understand the reason why you would go either way if you wanted to keep your job. And if you're in a gerrymandered district where you're going to keep your job either way, then it really is a choice. I think it's a choice, although I think some of them may be in districts where they would be primaried by someone more to the right on either social or fiscal issues and lose their job in that fashion. So it's going to be a choice of really, are they representing the people or are they trying to keep their jobs and whatever benefits come with it.
There's also the question, too, of whether the GOP isn't you know, basically the 8-year-old boy that's been taken to the woodshed for a good solid thrashing with a willow stick and, you know, swears up and down that he'll be good, but, you know, for a while until the next opportunity for mischief comes along. I suggest to anyone who thinks that the Tea Party is over and done with simply because they got their trip to the woodshed on November 6th, I would offer them a few cautionary words. I don't think it's quite that clean.
Michael, I hope
it's a little early.
Yeah, I hope when you bring in our guest, I hope that you guys have a really, you know, highfalutin conversation that'll, you know, probably be too high for a filmmaker. But I want to hear. What it's not just an ideological issue, and it's certainly not just in the interest of their funders. There are Republicans who believe that the best way to grow an economy is to basically lavish taxpayer-funded expenditures on the wealthy and on corporations that create jobs, and then the wealth will then trickle down to the rest of us in this indirect way. And I know you could characterize it in a way that sounds a lot more enticing than that, so I'll get out of the way and let you guys go at it.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to bring Ron on in just a moment, but just to let everyone know, of course, as always, this is a call-in show. We do have one or two people already in queue to talk to us. Our number here is 646-929-2495. Please feel free to dial in and press 1 if you're interested in joining the show. That's 646-929-2495. And tonight on the Middle Ground, I'm glad to welcome our guest, Ron Garrett. Ron is a member of Patriotic Millionaires. He is also a member of Sandhill Angels, which is, I believe, I'm going to let him explain this, particularly if I get this wrong, Silicon Valley venture capital organization that specializes in high technology startups and working with high technology or angel investors that have also are also working with high technology startups. Ron previously has been, and I'm not joking, he's been a rocket scientist. And so, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, the tax code isn't rocket science. Well, you know, it may even be tougher than rocket science. So, but we actually have an authentic rocket scientist on our show tonight to talk about tax and the tax code. Ron, welcome to the Middle Ground. And by the way, again, I appreciate very much your coming on. Ron just found out about this earlier today and made room in his schedule for us, which we appreciate. Good evening, Ron. How are you?
I'm good, and thanks for having me. I was on Fox News earlier today, so I have to say that it's actually very refreshing to be among thoughtful, reasonable people.
Oh, okay. So before we even go, first of all, hold that opinion, because you may not feel the same way about particularly me in 20 or 30 minutes. but you have to. You may be the first person we've had on who's actually got some backstage or green room experience with Fox. Can you spend a couple of minutes and tell us what that was like?
Well, so I did it remotely via a studio because Fox is based in New York and I'm in California.
Right.
So you're in a dark room, sitting in a chair, looking at a camera, and you have a little earpiece in your ear where you hear the host of the show talking to you, but you can't actually see them, so it's a little bit weird. This is actually the third time that I've done it, and it takes a little bit of practice. The first time I really screwed it up, and I think I'm getting a little better at it because I didn't screw it up quite so badly this time.
So I assume the topic was this idea of patriotic millionaires and the idea of a willingness on the part of many to accept more taxes.
That's right.
So why don't you start then? Tell us a little bit about the organization, and you know how and when. I know it's been around. It was new to me in the last 24 hours, but I did a little reading. It's been around for close to 2 years now, I think, or maybe a bit more. Tell us a bit about Patriotic Millionaires, what it stands for, and then you know a little bit about your conversation with Fox. I think would be interesting as well, because you said it wasn't all that rational.
So the full name of the group is actually Patriotic Millionaires for Fiscal Strength, and it's organized by an organization called the Agenda Project that's headed up by a wonderful woman named Erica Payne. It's not a formal group. It's just a loosely affiliated group of people who make or at one time made more than $1 million a year. And originally it was just Erica drafted this letter asking President Obama to raise tax rates on top earners, and she was trying to get some actual top earners to sign this because she thought, and I think correctly, that if people would actually be impacted by this, came out in favor of it, that would carry some weight and get people's attention. So the only thing that actually binds the group together is the fact that we've all signed this letter. And that's the only thing that we officially have in common. Now, so nominally we're nonpartisan. Nobody is empowered to speak on behalf of the group or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, except for the letters that we jointly sign, just individual members who stand up and say, I'm a millionaire and I'm okay with having my taxes go up. So
the purpose fundamentally then is to be a messaging arm for the Agenda Project on this particular topic, credibility?
I wouldn't call it a messaging arm for the Agenda Project. I would say that the Agenda Project is a facilitator.
Mm-hmm.
But we're doing this. The Patriotic Millionaire sounds a little corny, but it's actually not inaccurate. We're doing it because we think that it's good for the country.
What sorts of thing? I mean, you mentioned you've done Fox three times. You're doing our show tonight, and I assume you've done others as well. What are the activities that your loose coalition is involved in? I mean, what purpose do you serve? I guess is the question.
It varies widely. We have members who do nothing but just put their name on the letter, and then we have people like me who are more active and do a lot of media appearances. We have people who write books and write op-eds, appear in movies. I heard your co-host was a filmmaker. Did I get that right?
Eric is a filmmaker, yes.
Yeah, I actually have dabbled in filmmaking myself, so you shouldn't be quite so self-deprecating about being a filmmaker.
I'm going to say, sorry, Eric, he's subtly inviting you back into the conversation, should you want to join.
Okay, well, sorry, I didn't realize you were a filmmaker, too. I thought I was just insulting myself.
That's all right. I'm a writer. You can both insult me.
I've had a very broad and varied career.
So I see. So so again, we started to talk about some of the activities of the organization.
Yeah. So we have I'd say our most visible member is a fellow named Nick Hanauer, who has appeared in at least two recent documentary films that I know of. He was in Inside Job, which won the Oscar for Best Documentary the last year or the year before. And I just saw him again in a new documentary that is on the verge they're hoping to get into the next Sundance. When I saw it, the title was Inequality for All. And it was about income and wealth disparity and the growth of income and wealth disparity in the United States with Robert Reich as sort of your tour guide through that topic.
Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, I would start by just asking you the basic question. Why do you think it's a good idea for your taxes to go up?
So I fundamentally believe that taxes should be progressive, or at worst flat, and right now they're regressive. The more you make, the less you have to pay as a percentage of your income as a practical matter. And I think that that has all kinds of bad and corrosive effects for the economy, for society, and for even for democracy itself. And I can get into details about exactly what those bad effects are. But that, in a nutshell, is what's motivated me to do it.
Well, actually, I wouldn't mind if you spent a few minutes on that. I mean, one of the things that we look to, I don't want to say attack because that's a bit too aggressive, but one of the things that we look to dig into on this show is to take narratives that seem like they're conventional wisdom, and we kind of don't know why, mm-hmm. and dig down on them a little bit. So there's this there is a narrative that says income disparity at the level that we have it now is bad, right?
Yes.
And people who dig into it a little bit will draw some corollaries between income disparity now and income disparity under Coolidge right before the Great Depression and go, look. But clearly there are a million other variables that are different. So I don't want to just accept the assumption that this income disparity is a bad thing. Why would you say that it is?
Oh, what are the effects? Absolutely not accept it as an assumption. But yeah, so you can point to, first of all, the fact that the last time that income disparity was as high, income disparity in the United States was as high as it is today, was right before the Great Depression.
Right.
Now, that may or may not mean anything, but there's a data point. Then you can
Wait, hold on. You're a scientist. You know the validity of a single data point.
That's right, but I'm not done yet.
Okay.
Just getting started.
Go ahead. Get started. We'll go back and forth a bit like this. Did they not warn you about me?
No, that's fine. So then you can look at the income disparity of the United States versus the income disparities in other countries and compare ourselves to the kinds of countries that we like to think that we resemble, which is to say other modern industrialized nations, and also compare ourselves to countries that we like to think that we don't resemble, which is to say third world countries and dictatorships and non-industrialized countries. And what you find when you look at that is that income disparities are highest in countries that we don't like to think of ourselves as resembling. So we like to think of ourselves as resembling industrialized countries. We have the highest income disparity by a wide margin of any Western industrialized country right now. So that's another indication that something might be wrong.
Okay.
But then there's a theoretical argument. The theoretical argument goes like this, that if you have large income disparities and then you couple that with the recent Supreme Court decision that says that you can spend your money, unlimited money, on political advertising, now money is not just wealth, it's also political power and influence.
No question.
And when the disparities get so as large as they are now, you get this danger of capture that the very small minority that controls a very large percentage of the wealth can actually capture control of the government. And I don't know if that's actually happened yet, but there are some indications that if it hasn't happened, that it is happening. And there's certainly no reason to believe that it wouldn't happen. Because there is no countervailing force against it, and a lot of incentive for people to try to influence the government in order to steer it in the direction that they think it ought to be steered.
Yeah, no, at this point, you and I absolutely agree.
Okay.
I mean, we've said here. Go ahead.
So I think that undermines democracy, and I'm a big fan of democracy. I think democracy, for all its flaws, works well, and we ought to keep it.
Well, the form of it that we have, I agree.
Yeah. So you know, this all goes back to being a patriot. I think, you know, I grew up in the United States in the 70s, and so I saw and experienced firsthand what it was like before this sea change in policy that started with the election of Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And the trend ever since then has been really worrisome, and you know, I compare a young person's prospects today to the prospects that I had when I was growing up, and I get a little scared, and I worry on behalf of the younger generation.
Yeah, you would get absolute agreement from just about any member of the Coffee Party on the dangers of the money in politics issue, right, and Citizens United, and the need for reform in those areas, and we, you know, we sort of have a mantra around here that we need to get back to, you know, one person, one vote, not $1, one vote, which is certainly where we are.
Okay, but that's no fun. What do we disagree on?
Well, so the question I would ask is, while we agree that that's a danger, if there are mechanisms to deal with that danger that are independent of income disparity. Right? Now, one could argue that, okay, but, you know, it becomes sort of a recursive loop. The people who have the money are going to prevent you from ever putting into place the kinds of fixes that you would want to prevent the people from the money from putting into place, et cetera, right?
That's exactly right.
But that's sort of an operational issue that isn't necessarily... I guess the problem that you describe is exacerbated and made real by the income disparity in ways that it might not otherwise be. But it's fundamentally an orthogonal problem, right? You can solve it without changing income disparity in this country.
You might be able to, but
as a practical matter, it might be very difficult. But as a logical matter, they're separate.
Well, no, again, there's a theoretical argument that, nothing is impossible, but that it becomes so extremely difficult that it becomes effectively impossible without, you know, something on the order of violent revolution. And the argument is, I don't know how deeply you want to get into this, because this starts opening a pretty serious can of worms. So actually, before I get into this, let me make one more argument.
Sure.
Which is that it's not just bad for democracy, but it's also bad for the economy, because what drives a robust economy is robust demand from a large and growing and thriving middle class. And when you have large and growing income disparities, then your economic demographics start to resemble those of a third world country, where you have a very tiny minority that controls a very large proportion of the wealth, but they can't spend it all, because there's only so much that an individual can consume. and then this very large population that can't consume anything because they don't have any money anymore. And so you get locked into this feedback loop that locks you into a very bad situation where it's very hard to get yourself out because all of the wealth is in the hands of people who don't really need anything anymore, have everything that they want, everything that they need.
Yeah, that's I agree with you on that. And by the way, I'm not arguing that the income disparity levels as they are today are the right ones. In fact, they are, you know, historically enormous. And I worry, and I'm curious to get your comment on this. I worry about the sociocultural implications of essentially creating. I'll be quite blunt. Sort of a liege lord and serf split, which is kind of the direction ultimately, you know, kind of the 21st century version of where this could end up if the disparities continue. And then what you ultimately have is, to your point, you know, you have an uprising of the masses. You have the 21st century equivalent of the French Revolution or something of those of that nature. The kinds of things we've seen out of both, I think, the Tea Party and Occupy Wall Street, and this is probably one of the places where they do somewhat overlap, is that kind of anger arising, at least the Tea Party in its nascent form. So let me ask you before we get to a couple of callers that we have who've been very patiently waiting, and I appreciate. And Eric, by the way, your mic is open. Jump in here anytime. How do we determine, if we take the premise that the tax rates need to go up on the wealthy because, to your point, it's regressive, right? The effective spending power of the middle class is going down relative to, and I know you were referring to actually the middle class pays more because we have various other, we don't have either the loopholes or the capital gains rates or as the wealthy do at the same levels. But where's the right number? I mean, who figures that out? How do you know? For example, on your the Agenda Project, I believe is actually drawing the line at $1 million, right?
Yeah.
Whereas Obama would draw it at $250,000, which, you know, if you live in the New York metro area, $250,000 is not wealthy for a lot of people.
Yes, and this is one of the details that this argument gets hung up over. You first have to agree on the premise that rates should be progressive, and then you have experts, who politicians and economists who you pay to work out the details. Because right now, we're not even agreed as a nation on the premise.
I think we're about two-thirds agreed. I mean, looking at the recent polls that I've looked at, it's anywhere from 60 to 72 or 73%.
So let me rephrase what I mean by agreement. Agreement,
okay,
to the point where you could get a bill passed through Congress. And right now, today, you still have this problem of essentially a Republican-controlled Congress. You've got a Republican majority in the House, and a large enough minority in the Senate to be able to block anything because of the filibuster rules.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So essentially the Republicans control Congress at least to the extent where they can stop anything.
Right, they control the obstruction lane. They basically can put up traffic cones whenever they want.
That's right. And the rhetoric coming from the Republican Party is still, I mean, they're starting to bend just a little tiny bit, but I've certainly not heard anyone any Republican stand up and say, you know, Grover Norquist was just wrong, and we really do need to raise taxes.
Well, you have. They're just not in the Senate or Congress right now.
Oh, okay. But that's where they need
potential,
to be.
No,
that's
I say that.
To,
I don't say that with tongue
to
in cheek. These are potentially leaders of the party, right? The Republican Party is hurting for leadership, And if a Jeb Bush or a Chris Christie, for example, just to name two, are willing to take on some of that mantle and give people cover for, you know, the Grover Norquists of the world. I don't think that's trivial.
Maybe. We'll see. But, I mean, for the time being, we're stuck with what we have for the next 2 years at least. So we got to work with what we've got. And we have short-term problems coming down the pike that need to be dealt with.
So I want to come back in a few minutes and talk about this question about whether we should be even right now talking about raising taxes on any human being at all, which is not, by the way, the same as whether we raise taxes. I think they're two different things, as I've explained previously. But we do have a couple callers who've been waiting. Do you mind taking a couple calls?
No, of course not.
Okay. We're going to go first to area code 202, who's been waiting for almost a half an hour now. We very much appreciate your patience. Area code 202, welcome to the Middle Ground. What's your name and where are you calling from?
This is Will Rice. I'm calling from Washington, D.C.
And, welcome to the show, Will.
Thanks.
I believe you do some work with Eric, if I recall.
That's right.
I don't recall that. He just wrote that on the board here. So I know.
Yeah, Eric and I have been partners in that filmmaking, well, not filmmaking, video making that was being disparaged earlier. But but I've also this year been doing a lot of work on the issue of fair taxes, both with the Coffee Party. I have a small Facebook group called the Commonwealth's Page that addresses this issue, and also through a few other organizations. But I just wanted to say that I actually am hopeful. You were asking earlier whether why this wasn't going to be just another Groundhog Day. I'm with Eric in being more hopeful because I sense that Grover Norquist's iron grip is kind of loosening. One of the things I did earlier this year was have a protest outside of Grover Norquist's Washington offices. And we actually had a patriotic millionaire there. I guess I've been encouraged by people like that you would never expect, like Haley Barbour, the former chief of the RNC and governor of Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
The current governor of Virginia, saying at a recent Republican Governors Association meeting that that elections have consequences and that the Republican Party is going to have to be open to the idea of greater revenues. And my favorite quote actually is from William Kristol, the scion of a famous conservative family, editor of the Weekly
mm-hmm.
Standard, saying he didn't understand why the Republican Party, and this isn't an exact quote but it's close, would fall on its sword in defense of millionaires. I mean, he said, quotes, half of which didn't vote for us and many of which live in Hollywood. So he was recognizing the fact, and there's a real tectonic shift going on now. There are more and more wealthy people who are less like, the Monopoly Man character and more like Hollywood in the sense of being progressive, and not only in their social views, but in recognizing that there is an element of luck in both financial success and failure, and an understanding that having a more balanced economy, not having huge wage and income gaps is actually good for business because it, as it was said earlier by Garrett, creates a strong middle class that has purchasing power and just generally leads to a more stable society. So I think there's a really real shift going on, and I think the kind of old school rich people who support the Republican Party I think are diminishing in numbers, and this new kind of progressive rich class is growing, and so I'm fairly hopeful. I don't know what's going to happen in these particular negotiations, and I'm actually working pretty hard to try to influence them in various state campaigns, trying to influence the senators. But I think the long run looks pretty good.
Well, you want to comment on what Will said?
Well, I don't think I'm really qualified. I don't keep up with politics as much as your caller does. I hope he's right.
So, Will, if you don't mind, I'm staying on for just a minute.
Sure.
I'll ask both you and Ron a question. Is this in some ways a potential sea change in the perception of who the rich are? Because I think one of the things that has, and we'll go back to what I said earlier, Ron, about this idea of narratives. There are basically two fundamental narratives about the rich in this country that we hear over and over again. The first is the liberal narrative, and I realize I'm generalizing, and not everybody, and there are different stripes of liberals and whatever, but just stick with me here. The so-called liberal narrative, which would paint wealthy people as, you know, the hedge fund managers who are basically stuffing themselves with Twinkies while shutting down plants, right? And the conservative narrative, again, generic and generalized narrative, is that the wealthy are the job creators, right? And you can't, you know, if you start taking money from them, they won't have it to invest anymore. Both of which I think are pretty much false in lots of ways. Is there an emergence? Do you see an emergence, either of you? I'll go to you, Ron, first. Do you see the emergence of a new narrative that defines differently who really is wealthy and who isn't?
Again, I'm not really qualified to answer that. I just don't know. I don't have my finger on the pulse enough to answer that. I hope so, because you're right, especially this idea that the rich people are job creators. That's a myth that really needs to be debunked, because it's the myth.
Well, you were on Fox today. You had your chance.
Yeah. You want to talk about that?
No. Let me ask your opinion on that same question. Do you see the narrative on how we define the rich changing?
I hope so, because I think this is why a program like the Common Ground and Coffee Party is so important. Because I think, like you say, both stereotypes are false, and I think that I classify myself as a liberal, but I think it's important for when liberals just start generally denouncing corporations and wealthy people as, you know, just selfish and basically destructive. I think it's important to remember that. Starting a business is a very creative process. We do actually, everything you see around you has been created by some sort of corporation somewhere. And so I think being anti-corporate is this kind of mindless as being anti-government in general. So I think the picture of the rich people as being villains is a stereotype that's not useful. But at the same time, this idea of them being some sort of supernatural being who comes down and bestows upon all of us all of our wealth and all of our well-being is obviously also distorted. And I think that I'm hoping that one of the upshots of this big debate we're having now is that there'll be a more balanced picture created. And I agree about, and most business people I talk to, I've been talking to a lot of small business people in recent months, and they all say, I'm not a job creator. I only hire people if there's sufficient demand, and I do that as a last resort because it's expensive to hire people. So it's customers who are the job creators. And I think that that's something that should come out in this debate. And so I'm hopeful that out of this will come the I guess unsurprising conclusion that rich people who start businesses are neither angels nor devils. They're just people who are pursuing their interests and often being very creative about it, but that there has to be a recognition that you need to have regulation of that activity and you need to tax the upshot of it in a way that's equitable. And I'll just say one other thing, and then I'll be quiet. One thing that does never come up very much is this whole idea of inherited wealth. And I'm speaking from experience. I don't qualify as a patriotic millionaire, but one of the things I was trying to do this year in starting this Commonwealth page was to try to get people to be more open about their economic situation. It's often said people will talk about their sex life before they'll talk about their money, and I thought that that's dangerous and leads to kind of a debate in the dark. So I'm someone who's benefited from inherited wealth, and so it's very hard when they talk about higher taxes and how punishing success You know, what's success, or what effort have you put in when you're wealthy because you were born to the right parents? I think that's an important thing that should always be injected in this debate, and is carefully elided, even by the left. It's often about people making their money. Some people are just handed it, and the idea that they should be entitled to lower taxes on their capital gains and dividends is just ridiculous. And I hope that that comes out more in the debate as it goes on.
So let me thank you very much. Well, it's a really interesting point. I want to go ahead and ask Ron about that for a minute, and then I want to go on to our next caller.
Thanks.
Should there be a difference between the kind of money it is, so to speak? I mean, where it comes from?
Well, there already is differences between different kinds of money. So yes, if you have capital gains, that is treated, that's a different kind of money. It's accounted for differently than if you make that in a salary. So yes, we have different kinds of money already, and that is probably as it should be. Although the distinctions that we're drawing now are not the right ones.
How so?
But not all money is created equal. So here's one of the we should have an economic Mythbusters show. here's one of the economic.
You know what? I'm going to have somebody jot that down. It's not a bad idea.
So here's one of the myths that rich people got rich because they contributed something to society and they worked hard and sacrificed, and that they deserve the money. That some rich people are certainly like that, but they not all of them are like that. And the reason people believe it is because they think about it something like this, that we are in a capitalist system, and in a capitalist system, one of the ways to make money is to build a better product and take it to the market, and the market will buy it from you, and then you become rich if your product
sure.
is good enough and better than the competition.
Right, the better mousetrap theory.
But then they make this logical fallacy and say that the converse must be true, that therefore if you made money, you must have done it by this method. And that's not true, because there are lots of ways to make money in the system other than bringing quality products to market and competing effectively.
Well, it's very true. There are people who make their money by making other people more money, and there are people who make money by providing product or service that the market wants.
And there are people who make money by gaming the system.
And by gaming the system, or by inheriting it, right? So let's set gaming the system aside for just a minute. But
I think this is important, because I think there are a lot more people making money by gaming the system than is generally appreciated. My poster child for this is Angelo Mozzillo, who netted $37 million net of SEC fines and income tax, by the way,
mm-hmm.
for bankrupting Countrywide. Where do I get a gig like that? he made $37 million for providing negative value to our economy, in fact, for helping to precipitate the second biggest financial crisis in our history.
Well, let's back up a second, though. How did he make the $37
million? Salary and bonuses.
Okay.
As a Countrywide.
So he went in, and this is something that I like to dig into a little bit, because I think there's a little bit of a narrative here as well.
Mm-hmm.
If I go into an organization, or this guy, or anybody, I'm going to go into an organization. I have a set of skills. And I go through a process by which I am vetted by some organization that decides to hire me, that decides to give me a contract, and I negotiate a contract. And, of course, in negotiating that contract, I'm going to try to get the best deal I can. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a contract there's a contract now between myself and an organization, and they agree to do whatever is in the contract. That contract is not, if it's in the case, obviously, is the one you described, is not contingent on success or failure. It's contingent essentially on working every day. It's not. It apparently did not have success or failure key performance indicators built into it. Why is it not his right to negotiate that deal and to collect that money even if the company fails?
Oh, of course it's his right.
So what's wrong with that? I don't understand what's wrong with that.
The outcome is wrong. So we the object of the game is to try to design an economic system that produces wealth rather than destroys it. And in this case, manifestly, that failed. Now, we can talk about why that failed and what ought to change, but it's undeniable that it failed in that case.
There's no question that it failed.
Yeah.
No, I totally agree.
All right. So why did it fail? This would be a very long discussion in and of itself, but I believe that it failed because at the very top, and at the level at which CEOs are hired and at their contracts are negotiated, it's a very incestuous game. Most contracts are negotiated by two parties that have more or less equal incentive to negotiate a deal that is beneficial to both parties. At the CEO level, that's not true. The deals are negotiated between CEOs and boards, and they all know each other, and they're all sitting on each other's boards, and it all becomes an insider's good old boys network. And so they negotiate deals with each other that they would never negotiate if they were really negotiating in good faith on behalf of another stakeholder.
Well, that's a very interesting point. So we would need to separate two things here. One is the right of an individual and organization to enter into a contract, and the right of society to have some kind of oversight for situations in which those contracts occur in a societally sensitive market, such as banking or healthcare or something like that.
Could I interject? It's going to seem like a tangential point, but it's actually it has to do with this also, which is that this is something that that your caller brought up, which is that corporations are not the evil that the extreme left often paints them to be. I think the right way to think about corporations is one that almost nobody thinks about them as, and that is corporations are technology. They're a kind of technology. They're a human invention. And like all technology, they can be used for good and they can be used for evil. And when they're used for good, they can be very powerful forces. I mean, we live in an era of unprecedented material wealth, in part because of the invention of corporations and these legal structures that let people work together in ways that they would not be able to work together in the absence of these legal structures.
Mm-hmm.
But, like all technology, you have to design them right or they don't work. And right now, the design of corporations at the very top is broken.
That's a very interesting point. I hadn't really thought about it. I love the idea that it's a technology. It's certainly a human invention. You bring up a very fair point about the idea that while it's certainly within everyone's rights to negotiate the way that they do, that if they are not negotiating in good faith and are not negotiating certainly in the good faith of the at the very least in the good faith of the shareholders of the organization, then they are in fact gaming the system.
That's right.
So, and that's a fair point. Hold on, we're going to take a very short break because we have a quick announcement, and then I want to come back and take another couple of calls. You are listening to The Middle Ground on the Coffee Party USA Internet Radio Network.
Hello, everybody. This is Michael Charney, board member with the Coffee Party USA. Thanks for listening to the show and for giving me a moment of your time for this important announcement. The election's now behind us, but the fact that billions were spent across the country should still give us all pause. Super PACs alone were responsible for nearly $650 million in spending, all designed to misinform the public, or, to put it another way, to try and brainwash us. Well, here at the Coffee Party, we think we deserve to get some of that money back, and so we're about to start a campaign to try and do just that. We're targeting Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS. Over the next few days, we'll be announcing details of this campaign, so get ready, because we'll want active citizens everywhere to participate. It's our way of helping to send the message that the Citizens United decision and the super PACs it created are unacceptable. So watch our website, watch our Facebook posts and our Twitter feeds, watch the emails that we send you over the next week or so as we set out to invoice the super PACs. Thanks. And as always, we appreciate your time, your energy, and your thoughtful conversation.
Welcome back. This is Michael Charney with co-host Eric Beiler on The Middle Ground. And just a quick note, our Invoice the Super PAC campaign, the promo of which you just heard, is actually well underway, and we're encouraging everyone at this point to go over to coffeepartyusa.nationbuilder.com/invoicethesuperpacs, and I'm going to go ahead and paste that link into our chat room. And read through and click down the form and pop your invoice into the mail, headed off to Karl Rove's Crossroads GPS. Our goal is to flood them with 50,000 invoices. For those of you who are unaware, we're invoicing them. Each invoice is for $538. That's $1 for each of the Electoral College votes they attempted to buy. So go there to coffeepartyusa.nationbuilder.com/invoice the super PACs and print out your invoice and get it in the mail today. Thanks. Welcome back, Ron. Appreciate your holding on for a second while we get through that little bit of business. I want to go ahead to another caller now who's been waiting again for quite some time out in area code 513. 513, welcome to The Middle Ground. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Oh, this is Laura, Cincinnati.
Hi, Laura from Cincinnati.
Actually,
how are you, Laura?
One thing first before we get into discussion. The quality of the blog talk shows have been getting better and better. I mean, some of them are just really fabulous.
Thank you very much. You're talking about the technical quality, like they're easier to hear, or are you actually complimenting us?
I'm talking about the quality of the discussion and the guests.
Well, thank you very much. Appreciate that. You can call back anytime. Well, what would you like to talk about tonight, Laura?
Well, I want to address one thing that was said real quick, okay? As far as thinking of corporations as evil, I think there's a lot of different reasons for that. And from a consumer's perspective, a lot of them try to trick you into contracts that where you get screwed by making them rich.
Such as? Can you give an example?
That does have a tendency to give you a bad taste.
Are you thinking in terms of employment contracts? Are you thinking in terms of business contracts like mortgages and things like that? What are you speaking of?
I'm just talking about little bitty consumer stuff even. Stuff that isn't a big deal. Like the hassles you have to go through to cancel a service that's automatically renewed every month.
Mm-hmm.
I joined a health club. All of them want your checking account number so that they can automatically withdraw. So if you're in the hospital, you die, they keep withdrawing until, you know, something can legally be done about the account. I mean, it seems piddly to do that to people for $15 a month.
I agree with you. I think there is there's certainly a narrative that's built around the evil company, and I think a lot of them are certainly contributing to that.
I mean, you can't tell people, you can't tell people part of the truth and not the whole truth, and then stick it to them later without expecting them to hate you for it. Nobody likes to be fooled. It's not the 15 a month. It's the matter that you got one over on me, and you're trying to, bleed me dry $50 a month at a time.
Well, let me actually kick this over to you, Ron, for a minute. Thanks, Laura, for calling. Just hold on there for a second. The argument that I would make is that corporations. You gave the countrywide example of, ultimately, I guess we were on the, we the taxpayer were on the hook for some of that $37 million one way or the other, and Laura's examples of companies who abuse consumers. Why are we not focusing more on going after the corporate welfare, the corporate loopholes? I've made the argument more than once that while I understand the desire and appreciate the willingness from people like you to contribute more, should we be even taxing people at all when there are corporations out there who maybe we should think about first. You talk about income equality. You talk about corporate welfare. You talk about all of these things that would argue that we're starting in the wrong place by, you know, even though you're willing to, Ron, by asking you to give more, that there are other places we should be going.
I would certainly support raising corporate taxes. The corporations are not paying their fair share either, I don't think. And I think that's largely because, well, I don't know why it is, but a plausible theory is that it's because this regulatory capture has happened, that the inordinate influence that people with large amounts of money can potentially have on government, that they actually have that inordinate influence.
Mm-hmm.
And people with lots of money tend to be, a significant population of them are the heads of corporations. And if the corporations get taxed, then that impacts their bottom line, and they don't want that to happen. So they lean on the government to not tax corporations, and using many of the same bogus arguments that rich individuals use to get the government to not tax them.
So I agree with you. And by the way, I'm well aware that this is, and I blogged about this today, I'm well aware that this isn't necessarily an either-or equation, right? There are a number of ways to raise revenue. There are a number of ways to cut spending as well, but sticking on the raising revenue side. And pennies become nickels, become dimes, become dollars. So it makes a certain amount of sense to look at as many options as possible. But it does worry me that there is just a ton of attention paid to getting money from rich people. Right, and I don't even the definition of rich bothers me as well. But even if we go to the $1 million level, I fundamentally trust people to do good things with money more than I trust companies to do good things with money.
Heard companies are people.
Well, somebody actually mentioned that in one of the comments on my blog, and it's an interesting point. The corporations are people. My friend Romney quote is, and you and I both know, dramatically oversimplified. And in fact, there are still major differences between people and corporations. And at the top of that list is they're taxed very differently, and they're given different kinds of welfare, and they have different kinds of influence. But
and you can't put them in prison.
Although you can't put a company in prison, but
that's right.
But certainly, if BP is an example, they're starting to be more aggressive about liability.
It's a fairly extreme example.
It
but
is.
Romney took a lot of flack for that quote, and I was right along there flacking him along with everybody else. But I think he actually had a valid point that everybody missed, which is that corporations are consist of people. Corporations are, at root, groups of people who have gotten together to work collectively on something.
Yeah, I would disagree with you there. They form that way. And full disclosure here, my background is in organizational design and development.
Okay.
That's like my day job, right? So I consult for companies and help them improve their organizational structures, particularly small and medium-sized businesses. And there is a creature that evolves, a cultural, almost societal creature that evolves, that becomes independent of the people of whom the organization makes made.
That's certainly true.
And to that degree, they're not just the collections of people. If so, every time you had a new CEO, the personality of the company would change, and yet they don't. It takes
right.
a very, very long time for organizations to shift their models and their thinking and their cultures.
It's certainly true that a corporation is greater than just the sum of its parts.
It's not even greater. There's a quality of an organization that is independent of the sum of its parts, to the point where you could actually have a company like an HP. okay, Hewlett Packard. And you could change the business model so that was there was a CEO and no other employees, and everything was third-party outsourced through subcontracts, there would still be an HP that had a culture. The people who subcontracted for that organization would behave a certain way that was an HP way. It's a unique kind of – we're getting sort of off on a tangent.
Yeah, I disagree to disagree about that.
But in any case, getting back to the point, why let me ask the question differently, because I don't know that we actually come up with an answer of why we're going after people more than we're going after corporations. Here's the narrative I'm building in my head with, admittedly, and this is something you'll never hear on Fox News, with absolutely no facts to support this, but just a feeling and a set of correlative data points that say this is the way the world works. I sort of wonder whether or not corporations like the fact that we're obsessed with taxing rich people, and that it is in some way of value to corporations for us to be diverted away from thinking about them.
Probably.
That's all you got?
I've only just now encountered this idea. It sounds like a plausible theory.
Yeah, I don't want to come off sounding like a tinfoil-hatted conspiracy guy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you start taking a really certain extreme points of view, you can start to think about corporations and make a plausible case that corporations are alien life forms, right? Because and the people and the processes that comprise them are just like the organs that make up a regular life form. But they have sort of their corporate DNA, and they reproduce and they go through life cycles, and they grow and they kind of reach middle age and then go senile and die and beget little children companies. And so I suppose you could probably concoct a plausible theory that these alien life forms kind of view humans as a cattle. But I think that's a real stretch, because I don't think corporations are conscious the way that humans, and self-aware the way that humans are. So it's not like there is a corporate entity that's consciously rubbing its metaphorical hands together and saying, "Ha! If only we can distract these silly humans by making them focus on rich people, we can continue to get away with all this stuff that we're getting away with." I think that's a stretch.
Well, I agree with you. It's a stretch, and when you put it that way, I start to feel a bit like, I don't know, Philip K. Dick or Scientologist or somebody who believes in the flying purple spaghetti monster. I'm sorry?
It's not completely ridiculous, but it's a stretch.
Well, yeah, and I would not be one who would argue that there's any sort of organized effort, but there are patterns of messaging, and simply the fact, and I'm going to bring in Eric in a minute to comment on this, because I think this sort of starts to end up in his wheelhouse. If you consider the fact that the 1% media, as we call it, the majority of the media is controlled by a very small group, six companies, and if you add to that the fact that just about all politicians are far more beholden to corporations because of the way funding happens than they are to individuals, even constituencies. It strikes me as odd, given that information, that that even the Democratic Party, that is interested in raising taxes on all on the richest people as opposed to no one, that even they are not talking much about corporate stuff. I mean, it was a much bigger topic during the race, because Romney was just sort of this poster boy for both corporate and inherited largesse. But now that he's you know, slowly fading onto some balcony somewhere. That discussion seems to have disappeared completely. I'm curious. I'm going to bring Eric in. Hopefully, Eric, are you with us? I'm curious to get your take on this. Do you think I'm being, you know, yes, I would be crazy to say that there's an organized corporate conspiracy to make us not want to tax them. But do you think the general idea of, you know, it's in the powers that be interest not to tax the corporations, and so the story is about taxing rich people? Do you think that's so far afield?
No, I don't. I think that the corporations that bet on the Republicans this time could just as easily bet on Democrats, especially if they don't see the Republican Party changing enough to become a viable national party. And the policies they most want to buy are the lower corporate tax rates, the corporate welfare, the subsidies for big oil, big agriculture, all of these designer tax codes and designer laws that make it so much more profitable than it would be if the people were writing those laws, because the people have other concerns other than profit. So, yeah, that, I think that the Democrats would probably be just as happy if the entire focus is, well, exactly as they framed it. The way the Democrats have framed it is that Barack Obama would like to maintain the tax cuts that Bush instituted 11 years ago for everyone who earns less than $250,000, and for everyone who earns more than $250,000, that first chunk of money, that first $250,000, is taxed at the same rate as, what is it? It's the money above $250,000 that then becomes taxed at a rate that is the same as we had when our budget was balanced and our economy was strong. And there's a tremendous curiosity among the American people. What happens if we go back to the policies we had under Clinton? Because in terms of our budget deficit, we had surpluses. In terms of our economy, it was growing. What happens if we just kind of roll back the clock? And I loved what you said earlier, Michael, about a single data point. It is a single data point. We might not have a tech boom like we did, and we very well might, actually, but we may not have the same kind of tech boom that the Clinton administration, you know, oversaw. But I think that there's a symbolic meaning to this framework, and the Democrats have very skillfully presented it to us, that the Republican Party is going to perhaps fall on their sword, and, you know, Will Rice mentioned the Bill Kristol comment, and say, we'll block the extension of the Bush tax cuts for everyone if we can't get them for our funders, for the super wealthy. And that is, the optics of that are going to look awful. And on the other hand, what would happen is if the Republican Party said, okay, we've been held hostage to Grover Norquist forever, but you know what we're going to do? Instead of having one person walk the plank, we're all going to jump off together and have a pool party instead of, you know, instead of feeling like it's such a terrifying ordeal for one person to be set upon by Grover, Rush, and the right-wing media complex. And then what happens is, you know, those guys who would be bullying them and setting upon them, well, now they've got to bully the entire Republican Party, and that fever is finally broken. And for the American people, this choice between do we do what's best for the country or do what's best for our funders, that they see Congress together in a bipartisan way say, we're going to do what's best for the country. We don't know for sure that it's going to work, but we want to go back to the tax rates we had when our budget was balanced and our economy was strong. The people won. I think that would be a tremendously important symbolic moment. I don't understand all the intricacies of all of this, you know, all the tax codes and the subsidies and all the crazy stuff that had been built in so that people can afford a really great tax lawyer can get away with paying less taxes than their secretaries. I know that it's wrong, and I know that we could fix it if the government responded to the people. And if we had this grand bargain deal where the government appears to be responding to the people will be encouraged, they'll be more engaged, be more likely to vote, they'll be more likely to contact the representatives, and I think we can make progress in all the other ways in which our tax code and our economy are unfair.
See, I'm right with you up until the end. My fear is that it becomes a national Prozac dose. that basically what we end up with is everybody goes, look, they listen to us. They tax the wealthy. And we don't actually address, you know, Ron, to your point, where the real power and the real money is, right? And so we're now going to collect this, whatever it is, $45 to $80 billion a year. And I'm not saying that's not, you know, I said earlier, pennies equal nickel, you know, pennies add to nickels, add to dimes, add to dollars. But we don't go after the $450, $500 billion a year that would, unfortunately, in their eyes, put a dent in exactly the real problems that the Coffee Party cares about, and the one that you talked about earlier on, which is reducing the ability to buy the influence at the highest levels of government that ultimately disenfranchise and make us less of a democracy. And so my fear, Eric, is, yeah, we raised that $45 to $80 billion. All the Democrats go, look, we won. The Republicans go, mea culpa, but we heard you, and maybe we can win back a few seats in 2 years. And meanwhile, it's business as usual. And we sort of literally walk around like we've all had a nice dose of political Prozac.
You want me to respond, Michael?
Let's go to you first, and then Eric, I'll let you respond.
I think that is a very valid point. It's also worth pointing out, by the way, that the same kind of disparities that there are among individual humans also exist among corporations. The status of a small company in the United States is not at all the same as the status of a large one. And I can tell you many horror stories from personal experience. There are many brick walls that I'm personally beating my head against because I deal with small startup companies. That's my business.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not corporations. It's the large too big to fail corporations. That's really the problem.
Sure, and of course those are the ones who are doing the kind of funding. It's not, you know, believe me, Bedford Dry Cleaners down the street from me is not funding any candidates.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, Eric, go ahead.
Well, I'm also interested in startup companies. I've been working in the Denver Boulder area with a lot of young entrepreneurs and new entrepreneurs, and there's a lot of excitement about the law that was signed in April. It was called the Jobs Act, which, among other things, allowed for companies to be crowdfunded rather than funded by a few venture capitalists. They could be funded by many, many, many people from not just this country but around the world who could put a little bit of money in and actually get some equity in return. And what's exciting about that is that the choices that we make about which problems we're going to solve, which challenges we're going to tackle, won't be made only by those people who are already wealthy. And we keep talking about job creators, and I think it's pretty clear the Republicans mean people who are already wealthy. But what's really built this country, what's really, you know, who built this, it's not just been the Rockefellers, you know, and the Doheny's and the Sinclairs. It's also been those people who were striving to become wealthy, and many of them succeeded, right? And so the new frontier that we're on right now is that we actually may have a whole new sort of Cambrian explosion of new companies that come about because the people are choosing, well, you know what? The venture capitalists didn't want to take on dirty fossil fuels because it was so lucrative for them, so we're going to take it on, right? And so...
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to escape my pieces, and there are all kinds of new, you know, clean energy things come about because the people decided to fund them, and I think that the tax, the symbology of this tax question is similar to the big corporations and the little corporations that you guys mentioned a moment ago, and that is that you have these large corporations have already made it saying we're not investing in this topic or in this industry because that would be a competition for us. And so those companies go unfunded. Now the people can make a decision, no, we do want to see a solar-powered car developed. And it won't be up to that tiny little funnel of venture capitalism to decide. And so I just think that it's there's a super narrative here on how we do these debt deals. And it's whether the big guys who can afford to fund those campaigns get their way or the people who can actually vote get their way. And I think that my feeling is that most of these issues, we would make better policies if the ones who are already getting the upper hand, who are already in positions of power, weren't the ones making policies, because I don't think that's the way we grow. I don't think that's the way we compete on a global level.
I agree with you. There were many interesting things in what you said, and I actually agree with you. This emerging idea of crowdfunding businesses really has the potential to be, you know, for the 2020s what the internet was, whatever it was now 15 years or so ago, in terms of, and Ron, this is your world, not ours. So if I'm speaking in silly terms, just indulge me. But I do think there's a very interesting opportunity there. What I found in what you said, though, Eric, is this idea of, you know, are those big corporations who are doing the funding and writing the rules, do they get their way, or do the people get their way? And I think if I go back to what I earlier said, it seems to be possible to frame the narrative that both of those things might happen. That we think we got our way as the people because we've been convinced that we've been sold what our way is supposed to, we're supposed to want. That is to say, in this case, tax the wealthy people. And so we could walk away feeling like we got our way and they got their way anyway.
I see, yeah. So your fear is that basically we take the small potatoes and we never come back for the meal.
Right, so, because we're full.
Yeah. Well,
exactly. And we're happy. We're fat and happy.
Yeah, I don't see it that way at all. I think that having the Bush tax cuts expire for people who make above a certain amount is small potatoes. And I think a lot of people do, a lot of people see that as well. I think, like you said, Mike, I think you might be right that both of the major parties will be uncomfortable if the people start to push them to actually take on their corporate donors. Mm-hmm. And start to roll back some of this corporate welfare. I know that there are Democrats who want to repeal the oil subsidies and that sort of thing, but there's all kinds of other stuff that's built in there that would basically make the gods, what I mean is our economic gods, angry if we tried to mess with them. I see your point there, but I would much rather go down the path of the people believing that by participating, by exercising our voice, that we have impact, than to have two national elections, have Barack Obama elected twice, and even still, the funders and not the people are the ones who influence the way our House of Representatives votes and our Senate votes. So I believe that the Tea Party and Citizens United were both very drastic acts of desperation to prevent the people from feeling like they could actually self-govern, because that's how we were starting to feel during the Democratic primary of 2008 and, of course, during the general election, that it mattered what the people thought, that we could switch out the establishment nominee for this guy whose name rhymes with the most famous terrorist of all time and is African-American and is inexperienced just because we wanted to, you know. We were able to, go up against the Clinton political machine with nothing more than the internet and hope, and of course, McCain and the Republican establishment as well. I mean, that was the people doing that. And I think that the ruling class saw a lot of danger in that kind of enthusiasm among the people. And so the Tea Party story was generated. They basically took all the Fox News consumers and all the people who were essentially driven by fear and anger and hatred and made them into a show that they put on television every day. They told the people where to show up. They told them, why they were angry and who they hated and the policies that they used to support are now socialist and all that stuff. And they made us feel, wow, what difference does it make how we vote if the result is that the people who get all the attention and have all the political power are this tiny minority of people that alienate us. And I think that if they keep on telling us that, I'm afraid we're going to believe it. I think it's a man behind the curtain kind of thing. But if they keep showing us this fake Oz that's more powerful than we are, whether it's the Citizens United Super PAC commercials or it's this Tea Party reality TV show, which is basically a commercial as well, if they keep showing us that every time we go out and vote, they go back and show us how futile it is to vote. I don't know. They might actually scare us out of the process or demoralize us out of the process. So I just think that the kinds of – it's a step-by-step thing, but it's better to win early on than to lose early on.
I can't argue with that. I probably should apologize to you, Ron. Those who listen to the show on a regular basis know that I'm usually the optimistic one. But on this particular point, I've often felt like Diogenes with a lamp, just trying to find somebody who will listen to this idea that it's not fundamentally wrong to tax wealthy people, but that it's fundamentally wrong to tax people first. And so I still think that we're perhaps fighting the wrong battle here. In any case, we have one more call. We have just a few minutes left, and this call has been waiting for quite some time. So I want to take one more call, and then we'll come back and wind up with some last thoughts. Area code 404. First of all, thank you very much for your patience. You've been on for quite some time, and I appreciate that. Area code 404, you're on the middle ground. What's your name? Where are you calling from?
Hey, guys. It's Robert from Atlanta. How's everybody tonight?
We're doing well, Robert. How are you? Real quick, we just got a couple minutes. Do you have a question for Ron or a comment for the show?
I had a comment real quick. I want to tie a couple of things together. What you're talking about as far as taxing or having the wrong argument, I agree with you totally. I know you guys have heard me say this before, we're not going to get the funding issue addressed unless we get the money out of the politics, which is synonymous. And the corporations aren't going to be part of the rhetoric unless they are not able to do the lobbying. You know, Citizen United, again, all that did is bring the money to the front end of the story, but it has been going on that way for a long time. So we are entrenched in that way. And then, and real quick, when you talk about corporate welfare, it's a major thing. I'm a commercial contractor. I don't think I've talked about that part of my life on this show, but I am involved in contracts where, let's say, the owner, for example, I was involved in the building of Kia, the big Kia plant in Georgia, down in West Point, Georgia. And they're there, and they decided to move there. And, of course, they got huge government subsidies for moving there with the promise of hiring, you know, doing the job creation thing, et cetera. And then they rolled over the subcontractors on that job like a freight train. They put a lot of people out of business because they just felt like they didn't have to pay anybody. And that went all the way to the top. I wound up in a battle myself to collect money. And they can afford it, they can bond around it, and the laws are created to help them. When you were talking about corporations, you look at general contractors versus subcontractors, and you look at the way contracting law is, and it's all skewed, and it's certainly not that way only in the construction world. So I think you're actually bringing up a very valid argument, and that should be pursued and talked about even more, and that's to get the money away from the politicians, however it needs to be done, and let's have them serve the people, and let's deal with each issue on the basis of its merit, as opposed to who's got the most money to stop it. And I appreciate you guys all the time.
Thanks very much for calling, Robert. Interesting personalized story there. This idea that until we really attack the influence, I'm just going to call it the non-human influence, because it's not just corporations, but it's also lobbies and it's unions, and so it's not just the Walmarts of the world. You know, it's also the SEIUs of the world. Just kind of final thoughts. We all seem to agree that that's a big piece of this puzzle, whether we end up taxing the wealthy more or not. Thoughts on how to attack that, or thoughts on how to include corporate taxation as part of this conversation. Just, you know, should we be doing that? Is it a fight for another day? Just quickly, Ron, what are your thoughts there?
Well, as a matter of principle, yes, certainly we should be having this conversation. As a practical matter, that's a lot tougher, because getting anything done in today's climate is so hard. Although, as I've been sitting here contemplating it, I argued earlier against this idea that corporations are alien life forms as being just a little too out there. But I think I'm actually starting to change my mind about that, because even if it's not true, it's plausible, and it might make, to use your term, a useful narrative to get people viscerally motivated enough to take some action.
Yeah, I think you may be right. It's an interesting point. And viscerally is an important part of this. I mean, that is ultimately what makes us, you know, get up in the morning and care about stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no question about that. Eric, your thoughts?
Well, a large part of the show was predicated on the idea that the goal of many, and it was mostly characterized as people on the far left, but many maybe in the Occupy movement, their goal is to try to punish the wealthy or to tax the wealthy more. And I did a lot of reporting on the Occupy movement. I did a lot of filming. I did a lot of interviews, and I didn't see a lot of that among the people that were really thoughtful and that were leaders in the Occupy movement. But in the same way that the Tea Party could organize around the anxiety caused by the election of our first black president, I'm sure there are people who were motivated by not just how much trouble they were having with their own checking account or whatever, but also looking at how well people did in the process of destroying our economy. And feeling some sort of jealousy and being motivated by that. I don't think that's the reason why we should do this, and I think we're really fighting a losing battle unnecessarily if we say that's the reason to do it. My favorite thing that Ron said was that our economy is strongest when the money is flowing as opposed to all sort of coagulated at the top, because when people no longer have any reason to buy anything, and they have so much money, the only thing they can do with it is put it in credit default swaps and all kinds of weird Ponzi schemes. I mean, that's when we get in trouble. It happened in the Great Depression, and it's happened in the Great Recession. So we probably want to find ways to avoid that. And the question of, you know, the question of how do we administer our tax code is, I think, a symbolic thing that we need to tackle first. And then if, you know, because it is the only option we're being given right now, right? Barack Obama isn't offering us much in terms of repealing corporate welfare. But if we say, okay, do we want to go back to the tax codes we had when our economy was strong and our budget was balanced or not? We say yes. And so the tax rates on the people above a certain level go up. Then what our government will understand is that the people have a clear choice. And I think from this last election, they understand that no matter how much political advertising you pay for, that choice isn't going to change. And so then when we get to our next choice, do we want to repeal oil subsidies for, you know, tax subsidies for oil companies? Then the people say yes. Then our politicians will be afraid to go against that.
A very interesting point, and there certainly is a strong argument for taking small wins when you can get them, as long as, and by the way, I'm not necessarily conceding that it would be a win in this case, but given that people feel that it would be a win, as long as the battle is not misperceived as the war, right? To use that analogy, right? And I think in that case, we have more fish to fry and apparently more metaphors to mix as well. On that note, I want to thank our guest, Ron Garrett, very much. Appreciate very much the time you've given us. Again, appearing on the show on short notice. Great conversation from somebody who, you know, is personally impacted by all of this. It's great to hear from you. Much less theory and a lot more practical. I appreciate that very much. Let's see where this vote goes. I'm curious between now and the end of the year, and perhaps we'll invite you back on again after the vote's been taken and see what's happened and get your take on it then. So again, Ron, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
That's been great. Thank you. And Eric, as always, a lot of fun, a lot of back and forth. And it's I think always a bit more of an enjoyable show when we don't line up quite so perfectly all the time. It gets a little bit interesting. So keep in mind, for all of you on the Facebook page and over on my blog site, chasingglennbeck.com, where the recent essay on this issue is, I welcome your comments. Also on the Coffee Party USA homepage, where Eric has written about tonight's show, we welcome any additional comments on this. And thank you all for joining us. We will talk to you again next week.
That's all. our time for tonight. Thanks for joining us, and please share your comments and suggestions with us at conservatives.coffeepartyusa.com, where you can follow the middle ground and participate in the 99% media. Our theme was written and performed by The Consultants and produced by Van Gabriel. Please join us again next week on The Middle Ground. Until then, be wise, be strong,